There are many versions of the story of Persephone. And of course, an important part of that story is the celebration of all things green and growing in our world. In some of the versions of the story, Persephone's father, Zeus, conspires with her uncle, Hades, to have her kidnapped to the underworld. And in some versions of the stories, Hades is just taking his three-headed dog for a walk on the earth one afternoon when he meets the lovely Persephone and impulsively steals her. And for our purposes, it doesn't matter too much. What matters most, I think, is the relationship between Persephone and her mother, Demeter. Demeter is the goddess of the harvest, of the abundance of the earth, of the great trees. And when her daughter disappears from the earth, she mourns and in some versions rages against that. And so the earth goes lifeless. The crops die, the trees lose their leaves. Everything is stillness. And we know that part of the story. And then when the gods force Hades to return the young woman to her mother, the earth blooms again in response to that union, and the world is full of life. It turns out that Persephone is the goddess of the underworld and the goddess of the spring. Persephone holds opposite sides of the same story in her own being. She rules over the world of the darkness, and she rules over the world of fresh, green beginnings. Last Sunday, I somewhat offhandedly said that this congregation is a neo-transcendentalist congregation. And I think a couple of you thought, oh, that's interesting. What does that mean? And I realized that I've said it before, but I've never really explained what does that mean. So I thought I would talk some more about what I mean by that and what I think it calls us to do. And then Anne sat in the stewardship story hour moment this morning and gave you a really beautiful description of transcendentalist spirituality. You had no idea you were doing that, did you? Those are the best moments. That sense that her own religion was up here, that she knew something, that she felt like she'd invented her own religious life, but that it wasn't something that she could talk about freely with people who are in other organized religious traditions. And that it wasn't until she encountered a whole other spiritual world, in this case going to Asia, that things began to make sense about what she had put together in her own head. That is very much the transcendentalist spiritual experience. Of course, the other transcendentalists who you have heard of are Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Margaret Fuller. There were many more of them, and another day we'll have a history class and talk about all of them, including Octavio Brooks Frothingham, who wins the award for best name in the group. They lived in the early to mid-1800s and really did their intellectual work in the 1840s. And they had this notion that humans could comprehend something larger and clearer than the institutions around them could offer them, which doesn't sound like a particularly radical claim to us now, having inherited their thinking. They also had this deep belief in the goodness of people and the goodness of the natural world, which, again, to us doesn't sound like much of a thing to say, really. Of course that's true. But in their day, that was a fairly bold religious claim. They also felt that individuals were good, but that the institutions that we had created were a mixed bag at best, and mostly didn't do good things for humans. So political parties and organized religion were all not good for humans and didn't do good work in the world from the perspective of the transcendentalists. Ralph Waldo Emerson started out in the Unitarian ministry and is famous for preaching a sermon at the Harvard Divinity School in which he explained to them what was wrong with all of them and why he was leaving now. He had some fundamental differences with the way their religion was practiced, but he also thought that the life had gone out of Unitarianism, that it was stale and stodgy, and it wasn't responding to the world that they were living in. The world that they were living in was grappling with the questions of slavery, the questions of women's rights, and with how to create a society that met those questions. Thoreau, as you probably are clearer about, was so fed up with how society was going at that time that he was ready to just quit society altogether, mostly. He went out and lived with the great trees for a while. And if you've ever been down to Walden Pond and stood under those big trees by that pool of water, you get a sense of how tempting it would be to just stay there in that stillness. And that's what Thoreau was after, that sense of individual, quiet, and peaceful union with the natural world. He also went over to Emerson's house pretty regularly while he was living in the woods. Emerson's wife made him dinner and did his laundry. So society has its advantages. George Ripley, another former Unitarian minister, they were frustrated with Unitarianism then, started a utopian farming experiment just outside of Boston, which you might have heard of, Brook Farm. And they set it up to be this egalitarian farming community where men and women would equally reap the rewards of working the farm together. They had a traditional agricultural setting, and they also made clothing and some other handicrafts, which they sold. And they offered tours of their farm because they were a radical place where men and women were on equal footing. So people came to look at these odd people. They didn't get it to work out financially, which is always the trick with these bold experiments. But the idea that we might all be on equal footing and that we might be able to build something in the natural world on the foundation of agriculture as a new kind of life is part of this transcendentalist idea that the old way of doing things just didn't work anymore. We had to build something new. Margaret Fuller was a campaigner for women's rights and equality, but also she just stood up and did it. She was an editor and published her writings and was a speaker in a time when women mostly didn't do that. So she was a bold woman for her time, and she died tragically and too young, or we might have more boldness from her. So they each had their own way of going at it, but the transcendentalists had this longing for something truer and clearer than what they were encountering in the world as they knew it. We hear that longing in our joys and sorrows today. Most of their thinking about the spiritual and religious life emphasized our relationship with the natural world. They would have loved Wendell Berry's poetry if we could just bend time slightly. They would have appreciated his deep sense of the divine wisdom of the trees of the birds, of the air, of the sense that there was something about farming in its simple form that fed our souls. They were interested in individual people being one with nature, with the material experience of the natural world being an experience of the divine, which is why I often say about them, they thought you're just as likely to meet God or whatever your sense of the holy is out in the woods or fields as you are to experience that in church. I think they thought church was all right, but mostly they were really frustrated with organized religion because their Unitarian church was much more traditional than what Unitarian Universalism is now, partially because of their critique and frustration with it. One of the essays that Emerson wrote was entitled Nature, and I should be recommending this to you, but honestly, I don't recommend it to you as something to read. It's a fairly dry read. But here are a few words from it. So shall we come to look at the world with new eyes. It shall answer the endless inquiry of the intellect. What is truth? And of the affections, what is good? By yielding itself passive to the educated will, build, therefore, your own world. As fast as you conform your life to the pure idea in your mind, that will unfold in great proportions. A correspondent revolution in things will attend the influx of spirit. So the transcendentalists were calling for a spiritual renewal. They saw that Unitarianism wasn't alive enough in the world, wasn't responding to the world they were living in day to day. This world where women were speaking up more and more, where there were huge divides in their society about slavery, and where almost all social assumptions were being questioned and rearranged. So the reason that I think that this congregation in particular is a group of neo-transcendentalists is that you are caught in the same dynamic, living in a society that doesn't make sense to you, that you are not satisfied with. The particular issues that we're grappling with are different. But we hear some of them in the joys and sorrows today. We are responding to profound questions and shifts in the world around us. And all of the understandings that used to work are not working now. So we have to create our own answers and our own responses. And this congregation relies on its relationship with the natural world as a place for both strength for those struggles and also a place where the answer and response maybe is already present. Many of the transcendentalists, Emerson and Thoreau in particular, were most articulate about how individuals might go about their lives. Thoreau wrote this whole manuscript in which he went by himself off to the woods and really advocated that personal, individual salvation by going to live under the trees. And as I already said, he didn't actually manage it as an individual, which I think is important to know about his story. And this is one of the critiques of transcendentalism, that it was too focused on the individual, on our own individual knowing and understanding. Because we do have to have, as Anne says, that religion that we just have right here. But we can't have that in isolation. And that, I think, is what we've learned is different about a transcendentalism of the 21st century, that we have to be more aware of the interconnectedness of all life, that the religion that's right here is profoundly connected to the religion that's in each of your minds. If we step away from the organizations that don't make sense, we can find and create organizations that do make sense for us. I think this new form of transcendentalism keeps that awareness of the goodness of humanity. And it has an awareness that gives us the capacity to set each other free. And by set each other free, I mean set each other free from our sense that we are isolated. Set us free from the sense of hopelessness that keeps us living small, accepting less than is possible. And from the sense of hopelessness that senseless things happen that we don't know how to respond to. Years after the Transcendentalists wrote and talked and set all kinds of change in motion, another spiritual leader in France articulated what the Transcendentalists struggled to say and to live. And I think he articulated something for us to live into. These are the words of Teilhard de Chardin. "My starting point is the fundamental, initial fact that each one of us is perforce linked by all material, organic, and psychic strands of his being to all that surrounds him." It's useful to know that he lived the exact same time that Einstein lived. They were swimming in the same pool of thinking. I think that this neo-transcendentalism, which needs a much better name, takes into account all that the transcendentalists believed about the goodness of people and the goodness of the world. And this new understanding that we are profoundly connected, that we can't work only on our own sense of spiritual groundedness, that we can't go and live just one soul out under the great trees, that when we go out under the trees, our minds are linked to those trees, that here our minds are linked to the salt marshes on the coast, that our understanding of the universe is formed by the fact that we are of the universe. And so then we start to make choices and actions from that sense of being made from the world we're in instead of observing it. I think we feel like we observe the world around us. I don't think we're aware that we are made of it, that we are it. We just happen to also have the capacity to look out at it. And this is where the story of Persephone is interesting to me. Hades, in that story, just sounds like the bad guy. He's stolen the pretty girl and made the earth go into darkness. But his oldest name simply means unseen. He is the god of everything that's under the earth, which means he's the god not only of the dead, but of carrots and parsnips and all of the minerals that we find under the earth that we think of as precious. The Greeks had gods for all of the forces that we wrestle with, which is why we have the doorway ceremony here in January, because of the god Janus, who is the god of doorways and transitions. But they had gods for envy, gods for desire, gods for excess. They personified everything in ourselves. And so I wonder if the story of Persephone and Hades is, in addition to a story about the seasons, a story about the need to understand our deepest unseen selves so that we can have life again. This is the essential spiritual journey. To encounter the unexpected, to encounter loss. To then journey to the darkest place, to the place we cannot see most of the time. And to die to who we are and who we have been. To let who we thought we would be die. And then be reborn. Our understanding of our inner lives and our relationship to the world around us utterly changed. If we entered into that process, that story, with the sense that both we ourselves are good and the world around us is good, that idea that the transcendentalists handed down to us, what might we come to in this spiritual journey on this earth? How might we respond to the questions of our day, to the most pressing questions of our day? Because I think we are called to undertake profound social change. But I think it has to start with that inner spiritual work, with that religion that's here. And then take it out into the world pretty boldly. Because we hear from Dave this morning that things are just not right. And that we have to figure out how to respond. After the tears, we have to figure out how to make it different. And I think the transcendentalists have handed us another piece of this story, which is that they connected their spiritual lives and their sense of change to the natural world. They could see that there was something there that was sustaining and essential. They had no idea that global climate change was coming. They had no idea that people were going to be trying to pump oil across continents and spilling it everywhere. But it turns out that their ideas about the spiritual life and the natural world serve us well to respond to that most profound question in our world today. That's how you know that people are onto something, when all the circumstances change and their most essential idea is still useful. So I think we have to be about this inner work, this inner knowing of our spiritual lives, and then turning that spiritual work out into the world. Responding to the planet's crisis and responding to the crisis of violence that shows up every week now. It used to be every month, but it's constant now. And I think that the response is the same to each of those, although they look different. Environmental work might not be just fighting for a particular issue, but fighting for our own minds and well-being. So I think a spiritual practice is a way for us to experience that we are of the universe, not just observing it. And then our activism is a chance for us to engage that connection, to live into it and not fall back into observing it. One of my colleagues also a inheritor of the transcendentalist ideas, recently said this: "A different world is possible. A more peaceful, just, and joyful world is possible. We can remember our more authentic, connected selves, but this requires something more than momentary heroics or even the shared aftermath of grief and loss. It requires the discipline of a regular spiritual practice to support the remembering of our deep belonging to one another and our world, and to that transcendent power of love." This calls us to that visceral sense of belonging to the great trees and to every person we meet. This calls us to be like the trees, apostles of light in this world.